For WXXI, this is Connections, filling in for Evan Dawson. I'm Gino Finelli. Today's connection we made on August 21st. On that day, St. Mary's Church will host a community forum on the topic of homelessness. That forum comes at a time in Rochester when activists, politicians, and the people working directly with the homeless population see Rochester as in a housing crisis. The contributing factors to that crisis are nuanced and complex, but defined by rising rental costs and a shrinking housing stock in the city, plus a dearth of resources for the homeless that are already on the streets. So to talk about the state of Rochester homelessness, I'm joined by Andy Carey, a social worker with MC Collaborative. Andy, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Gino.
Janelle Duda-Banwar, PhD founder and director of On the Ground Research. Janelle, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Gino.
Patrick Hannes, manager of business planning and board member of the Reach Advocacy. Patrick, thanks for being here. And Reverend Ted Polano, associate pastor for community outreach at Third Presbyterian Church. Ted,
thank you,
for being
Gino.
Here.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
So there's a lot to get into with this topic. There's a lot of very nuanced things, as I've already mentioned, related to the circumstances that are happening in Rochester right now. But to start off, I want to talk about this forum and what the plan and goal is there as far as fostering a community conversation about what is happening with the homeless population right now. So I will start with Andy, and we can just go around the room and talk about what the intent is here as far as raising awareness and understanding and possibly finding solutions to the situation we're in right now.
Yeah, thanks for letting us speak on this. I think the biggest intent is to educate the public. We found that, you know, a lot of times when you think about homelessness, people think the solution is housing. And it becomes a very simplistic understanding of what's going on in our community. So what we did was we brought a lot of people together from all different backgrounds, you know, landlords, faith communities, different organizations that help homeless individuals, mutual aid organizations, and really started to talk about the problem as a whole. So the housing crisis, all the way from outreach to permanent supported housing and all the things that are in between, the shelters, transitional housing, wanting to make sure that people understand that this isn't just about building some apartments. It goes much further than that. And it attaches itself to a lot of things like the opioid epidemic, mental health crisis of getting treatment, that type of thing, as well as just some of the structural issues we're facing.
Yeah, and we want to make sure that we are educating people about homelessness, because even though those working in the field are very much fully aware that homelessness has been increasing, not everybody quite understands to the degree in which it's increased, the crisis levels, and the causes of homelessness as well, really that those are coming from policy decisions, and then focusing on solutions, that there are absolutely solutions to this problem in the Rochester community.
Then I want to talk about some of the costs that are associated. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can research numbers, but they don't tell the entire story. They'll tell you what it costs to access short-term community services, which are expensive, but they don't talk about the effects to the community itself, retail establishments, real estate values, things of that nature.
What do some of those things look like as far as the cost on the broader community?
Research values say $39,000 to $100,000 per person per year. Now, that's to access crisis-related, short-term, high-priced services, community services, such as the police, fire department, hospitals, jails, things of that nature. Now, when they've done what they have to do, these individuals go back to the street just to live like they have been living until the next crisis comes along. And then they access these high-priced community services again. So what happens here is you build up, there is a cycle, what I call a homelessness cycle, for which there is no long-term solution and there is no off-ramp, because we go from living on the street to having a crisis to go back to the street to do it all over again. But living on the street doesn't say what happens to if you're in the area of retail establishments, what happens to them, what happens to the surrounding neighborhoods, all of that is left out. And there is a cost that I don't know what that is, but there is a cost to that that people need to recognize. This is going on outside of the $39,000 to $100,000 per person per year.
Mm-hmm. A thing that I always come back to in these conversations is the idea that we do have kind of a system that's built on Band-Aids, right?
Yes.
Like as it moves forward, we're kind of building the cars as it's driving. It's if someone needs emergency shelter, there are some services that do provide that, arguably not enough resources overall to reach the scope of the issue. But what's the long-term sustainability of getting a person in a situation where they don't need that housing anymore, where they don't need to be in the circumstances that end up in, you know, consistent crisis, so to speak? And I think that's where, like, things get a little bit more complicated, right? Ted, I want to turn to you too and talk a bit about, you know, your experience working in this field. The faith community has been involved in homeless outreach for a very, very long time, and I just want to get some of your perspective, you know, what you see as the issues here and some of the solutions that might exist.
Well, I think we've been a little late to the party in terms of the resources that we have available, mm-hmm. both financially and human resources. So we're really trying to step out in ways that can make a difference. I think with the upcoming forum on Wednesday, one of the things that we really want to make sure is we tout the idea that housing is a human right. The problem, I think, to some degree, is when we think of the homeless, it's this nebulous thing, the homeless. And what we're trying to do is put a human face on that, because housing is a human right is great if people think of you as a human. If you're just the homeless, whatever that means, that's not really super effective as a methodology. So what we want to do, especially with the faith community, and it goes across all the faith communities. If you're Hindu, Sikh, you know, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, whatever, we all have this sort of global ethic, as Hans Kung said. So we want to put a human face to this, and some of the outreach that we do, walking up and down the streets, Monroe, North Clinton with Andy, just to begin to move the will. No systemic changes are going to happen until the will of the people and the will of the legislators are changed and moved to the point where they see this issue as a real issue with real human beings, brothers and sisters, friends and family, and begin to make decisions based on that.
So I think this is probably like the fourth or fifth time in the past couple of years that I've hosted this show and talked about the topic of homelessness. And every time, consistently, I raise the question of, well, what does it look like right now? What are the circumstances on the streets right now? And it's always a little bit worse is the response I get from every person I talk to. And this is the opportunity to do just that. What are you guys seeing right now? Is it getting worse? When I posted a couple months ago, we went to the point in time count. And at that time, there was a record number of family with children in shelters, and there was a record for total number of people in the shelter system for the greater Rochester area. So what do things look like right now? Are we in a better spot than we were, you know, 3 months ago?
I'd be happy to start with just the visual of it or the feel of it from our work on the street. So every week, you know, we walk on Monroe Ave, Lyle Ave, North Clinton. We respond to different abandoned homes, buildings, neighborhoods when they ask us to, spend time on Jefferson Avenue. And overall, it is exactly as you said, consistently getting worse. The amount of people out is, you know, just a constant increase. I think, you know, some of it's opioid epidemic, some of it's some other things. But overall, we're even getting called to abandoned houses that have families in them now, where that never used to happen. And it just has a different feel to it. I'm sure anyone who's driving around Rochester also gets that feel. You're seeing more encampments pop up, more people panhandling, more people just out sleeping on benches and that type of thing.
And I'll jump in with some point-in-time data as well as some other more recent data. So overall, from last year to this year, we saw a 32% increase in homelessness. So there's over 1,000 people who are who we know to be homeless through the homeless count in the streets of Monroe County. But we absolutely know that that number is higher than 1,000 people because of the limitations of the point in time count. And then when you look at certain populations within the overall people experiencing homelessness, one of those populations that jumps out are the chronic homeless. So people who have had multiple stints, multiple times being homeless in the last year. And those numbers have doubled. And then when you look at unsheltered, so these are people who we're not finding in the emergency shelters. They're not in transitional housing. They're not in safe havens. They're literally out on the streets. That number has also doubled from last year to this year. So there's 80 people who are unsheltered who are on the streets. And then if you look at 211 calls, so I've been looking at some of that data because we're limited in quantitative data on people experiencing homelessness because the nature of homelessness is that people are hiding, right? They don't want people. They don't want to be found because they want to be, keep themselves safe. But 211 calls. So the biggest call type for 211 calls is for housing and shelter. There's over there's almost one call an hour for someone asking for shelter in Monroe County. And then if you look at evictions, so evictions are increasing. We're increasing to pre-pandemic levels at this point. And the evictions are increasing specifically in the towns and suburbs. So we're seeing about one-third of evictions are coming out of the towns and suburbs. So really, by when you look at that data, along with what people are, of course, seeing out on the streets, homelessness is increasing. And like Andy said, we're seeing more families that are experiencing homelessness. People are becoming unhoused faster. People are homeless for the first time in Rochester, and people are moving directly to shelter. So in the past, someone might, you know, miss a paycheck, lose their job, and not be able to make rent, but then they could move in and stay with friends and family, but there's not room anymore. So now we're seeing those families, those individuals going directly to shelter.
So I just want to build off something Janelle's saying here, and that makes it this such a complicated issue is – myself as a journalist, you have to look at data to fully understand the scope of the issue. Now, all that data that we see on homelessness, the PIT counts, any other surveys that are done by nonprofits, they all have to be taken with a little bit of a grain of salt because you know that not only are those numbers short just by the sheer difficulty of counting people on the street or in the shelter system, they're short because a lot of people actively avoid being counted because of the shame of being part of the system. Now, for the government and the people that provide funding and resources to that, it is extremely difficult for them to find the full scope of the problem when the data can never really be complete. It would be extremely difficult to have complete data. So when we talk about things like this, and the idea that I keep coming back to is that when we have a shortage of resources for the homeless population, that those resources might be sufficient to meet what the estimated amount or the figures, and government loves to look at data and then create programs based on that. It might fit into the estimated amount, but it doesn't fit the whole scope of the problem. And I've heard different multipliers that are used in other cities to estimate, you know, extrapolate the PIT count to what the actual real world count is. And I don't believe we do that here, but it is a very, very complicated thing that if you try to simplify into one single figure, one single estimate, it's an exercise in futility. And you're never going to have an accurate estimate on this. So just wanted to throw that out there of why this stuff becomes so incredibly complicated. And Patrick, again, want to turn to you on the costing too. I mean, that has to be a very complicated thing to be able to estimate as well of, you know, how much this does cost municipalities in resources and to deal with the population that we do have here.
Yeah. I mean, take a look at as the unhoused population grows, encampments grow. There is an inverse relationship between encampments and property values. As encumbrance increase, property values go down. Property values will hit a point where you will get the interest of investors. You will come in, buy up this property, push out the renters, renovate the properties. Those that left can't come back because the rents are too high, as well as the sales price of the property. You get store owners will get what I call revenue impacts. If the encampments are around the around retail establishments, they get a hit because you as a shopper may say, I don't want to go there. I don't want to go to that neighborhood. I don't want to go to that shop because I have to step around people. You know, I don't want to deal with the aggressive panhandling, and I don't want to tiptoe through the needles. So he gets a revenue hit, but he also gets an insurance hit because he's in a high-risk neighborhood. Insurance prices are higher. He will get big security hit. You know, you can see these stores. They have these metal shades that come down in front of the glass. And from personal experience, you get that. You get closed-circuit TVs on the inside. You get mirrors on the inside. And some people will even have individuals sitting at a door watching people leave to make sure they've paid what they're taking out of the store. So they've got all of these costs that they exist because the homeless situation exists outside of the areas. And that affects the neighborhoods. Parents will say, I don't want my children in that area. Stay away for the same reason that shoppers stay away. Drug addicts, prostitution, needles all over the place, aggressive panhandling. It's an immense problem. It's one that's tough to get your arms around.
And it feels very multifaceted, right? That there's, within the overarching issue, there's multiple individual issues. There's addiction. There's lack of resources, whether it be money or food or whatever right. It might be that yes. Someone needs. Those things are all problems within the problem, so to speak. And you can't have one solution that meets all of the solutions for all those individual problems, which makes all this, again, it becomes so complex of what the issue is. And I want to touch on the VOA shelter that just opened in Cornhill. That was designed for families. I believe it to be able to hold 58 families at capacity, kind of meeting a need of a trend that we've been seeing over the past couple years, mostly post-pandemic, of more families entering into the shelter system. Families represent a unique problem for providing housing. One, because there's multiple people in the family unit. There's children. Sometimes there's a mother and a father, which makes putting people of two genders into one shelter sometimes is complicated, depending on the shelter. Is this enough? Is that shelter enough to meet the need that we're seeing as far as the trends are going right now? Whoever wants to go first there.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that because I think solutions are so critical. So it's part of the solution. And I like the way that you brought this up. So 58 families, that's wonderful. You know, there's a lot more families than that that need it. The support of a shelter system is super important as well because it can help with daycare, school, all sorts of things that are necessary. Because a lot of times we have to put families in hotels and they don't have that type of support system around them. So I think when we think about these kind of like shoveling in an avalanche situations, so we need more shelter. There's no question of that. And we need it to be more flexible and longer term nowadays than it used to be. And I think when we think about homelessness as a whole and how we can't get a good count on it or anything like that, we need to just work at the solutions and keep working at them. You can't have a finite solution. So if we start rehabbing some of the 5,000 houses that lay abandoned in Rochester, you just keep doing it. until you fulfill what is needed. Same with shelter. If you need more shelter rooms, you get more shelter rooms, or you become flexible enough to make the space for people to be in the shelters. And those are the types of things, you know, if you need medical respite for people, if you need transitional housing, you have to start and start working at it. So VOA is a nice start towards the problem. I love that they did that, but we need a lot more.
Well, and two, I volunteer over at Family Promise on Webster Ave, and I answer the phone 3 hours a day, and it just rings off the hook. And this is strictly about families. Family Promise of Greater Rochester deals strictly with families. So these are numbers that we actually have started to keep track of so that we can pass that data on to keep it aware. And the calls I get are usually from moms, and sometimes they're being evicted, sometimes they're homeless. But I think the work that Family Promise does couples in a lot with Project Haven, and it's a very slow process, though. Right now, they have two apartments. They have six more coming online in the next 6 months, and people can stay there for 2 years. And I think the idea there is you take a family and you surround them with the support services. So over those 2 years, you're able to live on your own, and your debt is clear, and you know what you're doing. But it's a slow process, right? You've got six families. But if we could get some more of these properties, give them to a group like Family Promise or the VOA and continue to have permanent long-term shelter with support services, it's a small piece of it, but it is part of the solution.
So that brings up an interesting thing to me, too, the idea of kind of having a concentrated place where you know where people are at and can – reach them with resources to begin with. When you have, and I know I've spent a good amount of time working in encampments and talking to people that are living out there, and a very good portion of the time that someone's struggling with mental health or addiction issues, usually both. Sometimes they're not, but I would say the majority of the time they are when you're talking about actual street homeless, living in an encampment kind of situation. And the thing to me is if that's a transient population that are moving from encampment to encampment as they get swept into abandoned buildings, into, you know, places where you never know where they are, how do you reach them with those resources that could help them be in a position where they could be in stable housing for the long term? And does the shelter system support that kind of methodology right now of being able to reach people where they're at, so to speak? I'll put that question out there too. I mean, do we have a system set up right now that is capable of doing that, of providing people the fundamental resources they need to help them transition into permanent sustainable housing?
Yeah, I'd definitely answer that. Because I love the idea of thinking about homelessness as a community. And a community that keeps itself safe, but also develops trust with service providers over time and that type of thing. And when we're out and about, and if we have to chase a person, so because they've been moved from encampment to encampment, over here, over there, it's, you know, it's just a waste of resources in my reality. So that means that instead of being able to see 20 people in a day, be able to go someplace where I know everyone will be and I can chat with everybody, develop those relationships, we get to see four because I had to ask people where everybody is and then go find them type of thing. And so we're not designed well to do that kind of thing. I think some places like in Harlem where they're doing overdose prevention centers, that type of stuff's really important because you get people in. There's a central location. They can work with social workers who can motivate people through the stages of change, all that type of thing. And get benefits to people, whatever's needed. And when you're just chasing, you know, it's a constant, as people have seen who've been out with us. So,
and I also think, too, that all shelters don't need to be, you know, 30 rooms or these big, large buildings. Having sort of a scattered site shelter model can be really effective because not everyone does well. I mean, you mentioned substance abuse and mental health challenges, right? So not everyone does well in large communal shelters. And so having a space where people can have their own room, where they can go to sort of cool off, and also experience the quiet, right, of what it might feel like to be in a place that's their own home. And so I think having those scattered site shelters also are can be more attractive to people who are living out on the streets who haven't felt comfortable or safe in some of the larger shelters. There's back to what you said, Gino, really this individualized approach is doable. It just takes some very real coordination and collaboration and really being responsive to the crisis in the moment. If we're seeing an increase in families, if we're seeing an increase in asylum seekers, how do we quickly respond to those issues? And street outreach is one of the ways that is one of the really critical ways to do that.
Do you think there also is a need for, frankly, the political will to do it, of to be able to really, really go all in on providing the individualized resources that are needed to address the scope of the issue?
Yes, I'll jump in here and let others respond as well. But yes, and getting away from the you just need to get a job. Like that mentality, certainly there are people are, have their own decisions and choices to make. But when we have, not enough housing, affordable, accessible, safe, available housing available for people, what are they supposed to do? So we policies have gotten us to this place. So we need policies, funding, changes to get us out of it.
I am going to take a call from Anne in Rochester, who has comment on aging with homelessness. Hi, Anne.
Hello? I think it's Bonnie.
Oh.
Hello?
This Bonnie?
Yeah.
All right, Bonnie.
Well, I had the question. Okay, I'll go for it. Okay. What I was saying, and I know this makes this, what I'm going to say, makes it more frustrating and complicated. But one of the other things that's happening is besides the cost of housing going up way beyond what a lot of people can afford, the other thing that's happening is that more and more people are living. Okay? And at the same time, a lot of people would rather stay in their own homes rather than go to an apartment, which is often what the state prefers. But when to do that, they need help. It's not so much they always need personal care, but they need, if you're living in a home and you're getting older, you need some help. And that's usually called living in place. And there's been talk about it, but that's about all. So if we don't do some of these things, and I can just say our neighborhood put in a proposal to an idea in order how to deal with the repair issue on a more assistant basis, but heard nothing from the city, even though we contacted them. So that's another piece, and that's happening fairly quickly. I mean, more people are staying in the home, want to, are aging. So if we don't do something about that, then we're going to have more people who can't, who can't stay in their own home. So that's my point.
So, Bonnie, is there a question there, or?
I'm putting out something. That's what I said in the beginning of this statement, is that I'm making it a little bit, more complex, but it's reality. And some of the things that happen with these details are that, the system tends to go more for high-end development and more expensive development in general, going back, over the years. And so when you do that, a lot of times you don't look at the current situation because, if you want to have your neighborhood, your elder people being able to stay in longer and you need repairs in these homes, because a lot of homes in Rochester are, older, but not ready to fall apart, but they need, repairs. And, people as you get older can't do all that themselves. And it's expensive. A lot of repair, handyman things are like, $150, $200 an hour. So we need to add that piece to it. But as I entered, this conversation, I know, people probably think, well, why is she adding something else? Well, because that's a reality. And we sometimes get out of reality so long. That's why we end up with a lot of these problems.
Okay. Thank you, Bonnie.
Yeah, I like what Bonnie is saying, because that's part of the solution, is keeping people in their homes and doing that type of thing. We've talked with a lot of landlords, homeowners. We are seeing older people moving out of their homes, which into homelessness has been a little upsetting as well. But there are solutions to that. There's preservation grants that city community centers can do to help people fix up their homes, and then get the support of the community center they're near. I know we do that in the Southwest a little bit. So that is definitely part of the solution, too, is how do we keep the people in housing that have housing?
To the credit of the city, too, and I hate using that phrase, but Mayor Malik Evans has put a very large focus on aging in place as part of the platform of his administration. There has been several programs that have been implemented that help to approach that, and there's been a good amount of funding put into that. So is it enough? No, I think there's always more that needs to be done. But as far as home repairs go and things related to keeping someone who's getting older in their home rather than having to go into a senior living facility, the city has made some in-grounds there in, you know, funding and doing that. And I think it's a good thing. And like every other program that has ever existed from a city level, when it's functioning well, there's always more we can do. And I think that's I think there's a little bit of optimism there that it's something that is taken seriously and could show fruitful results in the long run. So I have a call from Amy in Fairport, so I'm going to take that one too. Hi, Amy.
This is Amy D'Amico. Hi, everybody. It's nice to hear you on the program. I'm calling because I heard Ted say something about property values going down because of homelessness and that side of the issue. And I think that misunderstands the position of people who are not housed and people who are housed. I think they're on the same side. I don't think they're opposed to each other. And the reason I think that is because of the policy issues that Janelle was talking about. That homelessness is caused by unaffordable housing, lack of a living wage, and low SSI payments, and health and disabilities, and policy choices like DHS sanction policy, and we don't have a right to shelter in Monroe County like they do in New York City. Those are policy choices. And that's like the boogeyman, right? Unaffordable housing, lack of a living wage, not the guy on the street who's shooting up with a needle and is so very different from you, because he's really not that different from you. He's got a health problem that he's doing publicly. He's showing you publicly what his health problem is. But a lot of people are, you know, having a beer inside their house and saying, God, he's so different from me.
Thank you, Amy.
And he's not. Yeah.
I think Amy does bring up a good point there that I try to return to every time we have this topic on the show is you are a lot closer at pretty much everyone listening to being homeless than to being a billionaire or a millionaire. I mean, for most people listening, I think. But if you are just the average working class Rochesterian, you are far, far closer to that situation than you probably are comfortable believing yourself. And I think that is something we all need to be cognizant of. It's people are not that different from you. Because they're struggling or suffering from addiction issues or mental health issues or just homelessness itself. And I think that is a good point. And taking one more call, and we can go back to building on what this forum is going to look like. I'm going to take a call from Jack from Clifton Springs. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Hi. How are you?
Good.
I so respect the efforts that everybody on your program is doing. It's just inconceivable to, you know, address this kind of problem. But my question is, what are the root causes of it? And is there any successful program in trying to deal with not only the existing program, homelessness, but the increase in it? And are there programs set up that we're able to get the homeless into their own housing and apartments and so forth, their abilities to be able to maintain a household. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack.
Yeah, I'd love to speak to that.
Whoever wants to go first.
Yeah, so Jack is absolutely right. I think that part of why we're doing this forum is to talk about the root causes of a lot of this. But I do think there are some really effective programs. We've been lucky enough to work with Dimitri House. They have 6 apartments in their front house. Permanent supported housing. Folks that live there were chronically homeless before they were allowed to move in. And then they have pretty extensive support services. So they have a case manager that helps them. Then Dimitri House is a community center, helps them. And they're all signing their third year of leases in a row and have become very successful. And so those support programs definitely exist, and they can be tailored to people. They're just at such a small scale that you can't really see the effects of them. And also you don't see the effects because people are doing well. So,
and I don't want to leave out Project Haven.
Absolutely.
As a solution where the unhoused are brought into a housed situation and provided with wraparound services that address all of the socioeconomic needs that an individual have, with the goal of having this individual be able to live independently and hold down a full-time job. Now, we do 2 things with that. They have this person is now a contributing member of society, and we break this cycle of homelessness one person at a time. And that's what we're here to do.
And there are communities across the country that have had some success around reducing homelessness. Chattanooga, Tennessee is one of them. Houston is regularly referenced. And then California actually had some effective work done with Project Room Key during the pandemic. Since the pandemic, that program has ended. And so they've seen an increase in homelessness. I'm sure you've seen it in the news. But what communities that have been successful in reducing homelessness have done, it has really been what we're pushing has been addressing it as the full spectrum, from outreach to people who are, you know, living on the streets in the encampments, all the way to people who are in their apartment. They've been in this apartment for years and they just need a little bit of help with some home, with some repairs or with some rental assistance, and then to helping landlords, right? So making sure that everybody who assists with housing is able to be fully funded to do what they do best, and not treating everybody in the same exact way,
which I think goes back to part of the core problem, as I see it, is again taking this group of people that aren't housed and making them into numbers, making them into data. I mean, Dr. Janelle, I love the data. It's always great. But the reality is, until the will of the people and the will of the legislators changes enough to invest in these institutions and these programs, then we're just going to have this same conversation. Well, what's the solution? Well, we know the solution, right? We talk about it all the time. The solutions are there. But how do we mobilize people? And that's what we started to do in some of the faith communities, like this forum that we have coming up on Wednesday. I emailed all my folks at Third Presbyterian Church and I said, we have this forum. Please reach out to your county legislator and invite them so they can hear and see what's going on. And so if we can continue to mobilize people, we can get the money, we can get the resources, we can begin to change the systems, because until the system changes, nothing's going to change. And until we as a community, locally and nationally, see everybody as a human being with a face, with a name, Sean, Debbie, Farah, until that happens, we're just going to keep having this conversation because, again, I think the will of the people has to change.
Before we take our first break of the hour, I wanted to ask you a question on this, too. Do you think that we often make the perfect the enemy of the good in situations like this? And I think of overdose prevention centers in particular as just an example of that. Are OPCs being set up in communities going to completely solve addiction problems? No, of course not. No one reasonably could ever believe that. But it does seem like when there's so much hesitancy and hand-wringing around something that does have quantifiable metrics of the success they do have in preventing death and getting people into resources, we kind of look at it like, well, you know, there's more shoplifting that happens around areas where there's OPCs. There's been some studies on that. Or there's more, there's still people that overdosed within that area that it's like, well, we can't do it because of that and we just don't look at all the positives. We look at the negatives, and then we are stuck doing the same thing we've been doing, and nothing's changing, and it's getting worse. And then we were like, kind of sitting there thinking, like, well, how could we have prevented this? And it's like, well, we didn't try anything new. We kind of just did the same thing over and over and over. We're going to take our first break of the hour, and we'll come back and we can talk more about that.
Coming up in our second hour, a frank conversation about gun violence in Rochester. How many people have guns? How many young people have guns, legally or illegally? Where are they coming from? And what in the world can we do about it? After a mass shooting at Maplewood at a park when hundreds of people were just out barbecuing. We'll bring back that recent conversation next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from GreenSpark Solar, serving the greater Rochester and Finger Lakes regions for over 20 years. GreenSpark Solar is dedicated to helping people power their homes and businesses with local solar power and battery storage backup. More at greensparksolar.com.
A small city in Kentucky is at the heart of the weight loss drug boom, and it's caused supply shortages for patients who use drugs like Ozempic to treat diabetes or to lose weight.
He checked every pharmacy in a 300-mile radius and just could not find his prescription in stock anywhere.
More from Bowling Green, Kentucky, plus the Democratic National Convention on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And we're back on Connections. I'm Gino Finelli. We are talking about the issue of homelessness today and the many, many multifaceted problems within the problem. And while we were on the break, Ted had mentioned something that I think is really something good to build off of here. You mentioned showers and some of the really little things that are needed that could help. And I wanted to get an idea from the people here. What are the small things that are really necessary right now? I mean, we can talk about overarching issues and, you know, the big philosophy of changing things, but what are the little things that are necessary?
Well, that's interesting that you should ask, because I'm at Third Presbyterian Church at the corner of East and Meigs. And if you go down Meigs, there are a number of unhoused people there in front of Health Reach near Alexander. And the church has been talking about how can we help, and we come up with all these ideas, but no one knows if they're valuable. So I just went down. I sat next to Sean and a couple other guys, and I'm like, what do you need? And he said, you know what we need? We need more shower time and more laundry. Simple, right? And you look at some like Asbury down east a little bit further. They do that 7 to 9 Monday, I'm sorry, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, but there's just not enough time. So, you know, we're going to assist them keeping that open. But it's something simple. And again, human dignity, clean clothes, and having a place to shower. So I think it is some of these small things that people can get really involved with and making happen.
And I'll put a plug in here for the Father Tracy Advocacy Center, where they have showers for people to use. They have clean clothes, clean underwear that people can change into. You can use the bathroom there at any time. I know that the libraries are a good place for that as well, but libraries close. Neighborhood centers close. And so what happens at night, right? And so these things that these are basic needs, right? We have to, you know, go to the bathroom, we have to shower. And so while they seem little to us, these are huge. And Ted, I love that you said, I just went and asked the people, anybody what they needed, right? That's exactly what should be done. But then the flip side of that is it needs to be funded, right? How are these neighborhood centers, are you getting funding to open up a shower truck, right? To run a shower truck and everything that it takes to do that. And these need to be sustainable as well.
I keep thinking back to this conversation I had with an outreach worker probably about a year ago when we were at an encampment and talking about just homelessness as an issue. And he started talking about just how tedious it is to be actually on the street. Think about like all the simple things you need to do if you have a job interview, and one of the people she was working with did have a job interview, but they had to get their clothes cleaned, and then they had to find out how to get to the job interview, and they had to figure out how to charge their phone so they had an alarm. Just like every little tiny thing that we all take for granted, it's just very, very simple and easy to do. never a job interview is never a simple, easy thing to do. It's never fun, but like, it's a situation where the cards are stacked up against you, and then getting out of that is even more complicated, and it's even more stacked against you. And it's a system that exists where, if you want to get out of it, you have to work a lot harder than someone who is not a part of it or is outside of it. And I think about that a lot, and, just, it's a vicious, vicious cycle, that is designed to keep people within the system. And to kind of close out here, we have about 5 minutes left of, what can the average person do? We sit here and talk about what can politicians do, what can, you know, organizations do, what could big money do, but what can someone who's just listening, who sees, you know, people on the street, wherever they go in Rochester, which I'm sure they do if you're driving in the city, what helps? What makes for a positive effect on the community? Anyone can go first.
I'll start out. So I think, you know, you're right. There are a lot of things that individuals can do, you know, pushing policy, legislation, getting involved, that type of thing. And if you really want to be involved, REACH was actually started by a bunch of citizens. So, you know, Sister Grace had a press conference and said, we need to be able to house more homeless people. And a bunch of community members came together and started an entire organization that did winter shelters and now has expanded past that. But then there's the little things that people can do. Because when you talk about how hard it is to get out of homelessness, you have to have some sense of hope and some sort of recognition for being human. So I think a lot of times just smiling, saying hi to people, that kind of thing has a much more profound effect than you know. And I really like what Reverend Ted just said about talk to the experts. Go ahead and say hi to somebody. See what they need. And a lot of times you'll find out, you know, it's just a, you know, a smile, maybe a sandwich or something if you have that to give. But just really starting to recognize all people as people is really important right now, especially. So.
And I would jump in and say donations are great. Donate to some of these organizations that are providing these services. But not only money, donate time, volunteer, show up, go there, interact with the experts, right? Learn about their experiences so that you can do better in the work that you do yourself.
Yeah, and that's so true. And I think just walking down the street, and I tell my folks that I don't think when someone approaches you and asks for money, I don't think you have an obligation to give them money. Like, if you want to buy them a sandwich or do something, that's fine too. But you do have an obligation to look them in the eye, to say hi, maybe ask their name or share your name. But again, that humanization of them and the hope that Andy talked about is so real. Now, I understand safety concerns, and I think you have to be careful, but come with REACH Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday in a group. Go down the street, meet people. And again, you realize they're just human beings like us. Something went wrong at some point. But I think, again, that's a really critical point, is seeing people as people.
I would agree with all of that. I'm new to this. And one of the big things I've seen is Andy with his outreach, walking the streets, and the few that I've done in taking pictures and things like that, to walk up and you need a pair of socks, ask a question. This person is a person, okay? It's just not somebody living under a cloth up under the freeway. It's a person, and it makes a difference. And it's easy to do, and if you don't want to do it by yourself, maybe we need to publicize more of your outreach walks and say, come and join REACH while we walk these neighborhoods on these particular days.
Yeah, and I just, I think we're just at a point in society, big picture, where we have a real distrust of each other. And yes, we're all just on guard all the time, and you don't have to be. Yes, you have to look out for your safety, but you're not always in danger, and you can be kind to people without, you know, being terrified or dismissive of them as a person, it makes life a little better. Maybe you'll meet someone interesting. You never know. So with our last couple minutes here, I want to give you a chance to all talk about the work that you do and where we can all hear more about it. Andy, I'll start with you. Tell us about MC Collaborative and what you do.
All right. So MC Collaborative, we're a support service group, and we usually work with people who have really significant mental health, substance use issues, often facing homelessness. And we're really just working to build supports around people where they're at and really listen to them as the experts in their situation. To find out a lot more about the work, I guess on the 21st, Wednesday the 21st at 6:30 at the Dugan Center, that's St. Mary's by Washington Square, you can hear a lot of people talking about all these different homeless issues. And I think when we think about fear and anger and, you know, this is a good way to turn that energy into something positive. Let's start moving forward. We have landlords, we have shop owners, we have service providers, everybody. Let's use that energy for something positive.
Janelle, tell me a bit about on-the-ground research and the work you do.
Yeah. So I work with mostly nonprofits on implementing, tracking, and evaluating the work that they do. So interventions that they implement or just generally the programming that they offer and the effect that it has on their organization and on the neighborhood. That's what I do.
Patrick, I just learned about your work at Reach Advocacy, but it's fascinating. We should definitely talk more in the future, but can you tell me a little bit more about what you do there?
I am in charge of business planning. I write the business plans for the organization and the implementation of the same. Okay. In addition to this homelessness issue, which has been extremely interesting for me because it's a way for me to give back. Being retired, coming from a corporate background, this was a whole new world for me.
And Ted, tell me about your work with the 15 seconds we have left.
Well, at Third Presbyterian Church, we have a food cupboard on Thursdays that's open from 9 to 11, and we've been going gangbusters. The numbers are way up. A meal, a Saturday lunch. But I think what we're really trying to do is support all the great work that the other organizations are doing out there, mobilizing our people to support and care.
Gotcha. Well, thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.